Does a six-legged mouse prove evolution or human arrogance?
Welcome to Answers News for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tim Chafee, and I'm here with Patricia Engler and Brian Osborne.
Hi, guys.
So, did this Portuguese student and his Ukrainian graduate student want to make a six-legged, sexless mouse? That
well
is
done.
Our lead article for
Way
today.
To get through that.
That sounds like an interesting one, doesn't it? So, anyways, there are people who are manipulating genetics, and they're working with this little mouse, and as it's developing, they are turning certain switches on and off, genetic switches, and they were able to create one where the organs are on the outside of the body, not the inside. Probably not a good thing for that mouse, right? And it has no genitalia, and it has six legs instead.
Bravo.
So, if this is supposed to prove evolution in some way, shape, or form, or support it, do you think this is an evolutionary dead end?
I would say so. I mean, it's interesting. In developmental biology, evolutionists often point to these types of mutations because they cause big changes when things are happening at a developmental level. It's just all this like crazy, complicated, intricately choreographed chain reactions of proteins, making sure that everything happens at just the right step at the right time to pull off making an entire organism, which is a pretty big job.
It's a good thing evolution got it right the first try, right?
Amazingly, right? No, it's completely impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what we do see when mutations happen, they do cause these big changes, but you're not adding new genetic information, you're actually corrupting the information that's already there. So the mouse already had the information for legs, they just turned off a switch, a genetic switch that regulates whether or not legs develop.
Right, and you can see it on the slide here where you've got the six limbs there rather than four limbs and genitalia. So.
The first sentence of the article kind of cracked me up. It says a six-legged mouse embryo with extra limbs in place of genitals has been engineered by scientists. Engineered by, like, you really planned on that? You were trying to create that, which is a terrible idea.
You're proud of this one?
You're proud of that? You put the word engineered? And then they really do talk about the amazing complexities you were alluding to already, even not just of how the sequence of the events, but also the complexity of DNA. The more we're interested about DNA, it's multiple layers of information that communicate different things at different times. So if you could imagine creating a secret code, you got a key to the code, all these letters back to back, there's a key to translating the code. There's code on the front and there's code on the back. They both communicate something. But also, you have to bend the paper in a particular way, and that communicates something else. And when you bend the paper in a particular way, that communicates something else, and it all makes sense. It works together. I mean, and that's just a minor taste of the complexity of the DNA. And so these guys and gals are trying to find a way to manipulate it to their means, whatever they might be. And all they're really doing is messing up what's already there. As you were saying, they're not really making anything new.
That's right, and of course, for evolution to happen, you're going from a creature that doesn't have the information, and somehow you have to add new genetic information. Well, it doesn't happen through mutations, because that's going to result in a net loss of information, or it's going to corrupt what's there. You're not getting, for example, it's not getting information for feathers or wings or things that the mouse wouldn't have in the first place. So that's a problem. I think another issue that comes up is you won't hear too many people complain about this in this case, but if it were... we're told in Scripture to be good stewards of what God has given us. Mm. And that doesn't mean that we're necessarily opposed to doing certain testing on animals if it's going to show benefit to humans in some way, because humans have greater value than animals. But if you're just doing it just to do it, if you're doing it just to, you know, to create things like this, well, then is it really justifiable, I guess, is a fair question to ask.
Right, I guess they're trying to learn about like spinal development, but it just goes to show that like they totally weren't expecting this to happen. So we're just starting to scratch the surface of all the steps and all the complexity that goes on, even to develop one mouse. So if we, with all our brilliant knowledge, are just beginning to figure this stuff out, it really shows you how fearfully and wonderfully made we are.
And I love that conclusion, too. It says, our work uncovers a remarkable tissue plasticity with potential implications in evolution and hindland genital area for tetrapods, forelimbed vertebrates. Like, no, it just shows you're messing up what you don't understand.
Basically, yep. Yeah, so it leads to...
Brian, you're not going to tell us the name of the gene that they were messing with? He did so well back
then. Oh, yeah, no, it's a transforming growth factor beta receptor type 1.
That'd be a great password.
It really would be a good one. You type it in four times wrong, and then you got to get your password changed. All right, well, we want to give a little bit of a warning on this one, a little parental advisory on the next article. It is one of the most disturbing ones that I think. It's that I've covered, it's the most disturbing one. You know, we'll still talk about it like a PG level as much as possible. But it, so I just want you guys to, anybody watching at home, here's your 5-second heads up that this is it's very disturbing. All right, here we go. So, married homosexual arrested for child pornography is allegedly planning to abuse a surrogate baby. So this is a veterinarian from the Chicago area who is also one of the judges for the famous, what is it, Westminster Dog Show? Mm-hmm. Who one of the famous dog shows. Yeah, that's it, the Westminster one. And so here, he and his husband, partner, were going to buy a baby from California, and he is admitting that they were doing it for the express purpose of abusing that child and even inviting a third person to come and do that. So it's about as disturbing of a news item that you can imagine. And I'll turn it over to Brian. We went Patricia first last time. Who looked most like a deer in the headlights?
Nobody wants to talk about this at all. So, yeah, this guy named Adam Stafford King, a veterinarian, like you said, a judge at a dog show. He was arrested for distributing, for allegedly having and distributing child pornography, and also for drugging children in order to sexually assault them. And he actually bragged on a particular chat site that he had done so with his nieces and nephews. He even talked about how he used large doses of Benadryl to make this happen. And they were literally, him and his partner were, as you said, they were buying a baby for the express reason they claim to abuse that baby. And it just shows a level of depravity and the way sin can just snowball and then make us numb and sear our consciences. It is absolutely horrific. Most of the stuff I don't really want to talk about in the article, but what it does really show is when you abandon God and his absolutes and what he has ordained for us and laid out for us in his word, then truly anything does go in the minds of man as we abandon that, and God releases us over to our sin. And this is, don't miss it. It is he's been released over to his sin, being given over to a depraved mind. That is what this is.
And I think he knows it. Like, if you look at his
the name
that he uses for that place is, it's an abbreviated form of pervert Chicago guy.
Yeah.
So he knows what he's doing is perverse, or he's bragging about it, and it's obscene is really one way to label it, but it's far worse. And
And it's not to say that like any certain types of people or surrogate parents are more like who's most likely to abuse kids, because we know anyone has that potential to be sinful. But really the point is that when you depart from God's designs, people do get hurt, and it does have that kind of snowball effect. It shows you we need to share the gospel. We need to be modeling lives that are transformed by the gospel, loving people who have been hurt by departures from God's word, and thinking ethically. The article did go over some of the regulatory concerns, possible problems that can be involved with surrogacy. So we don't take a stance on saying what about those issues could be specifically right or wrong for conclusions, but to just give you a couple of the ethical principles that you'd want to think through. I've heard it explained how surrogacy can differ from adoption, because adoption done ethically, you are rescuing a child who already exists from a situation where they couldn't safely live with their parents, whereas surrogacy creates a situation where you're intentionally removing the child from the birth parent. And a big problem is that it can be done in a way that treats the child as property as well, and we don't want to be doing anything that could commoditize people who are made in God's image, devalue them at all. So those are a couple of the issues.
And you said it can be done that way. It doesn't mean that anybody who's ever used a surrogate is doing that.
Exactly.
And we want to be careful about the other side as well. We're not saying that every single person who identifies as LGBT, you know, that they're doing this either.
Right.
I mean, this person, what they're doing is obscene and vile, and there's not enough, the thesaurus doesn't have enough words to describe what this person is doing.
But also an interesting point with that, though, if you do abandon the biblical worldview of absolute truth and absolutes given by God and absolute morality, how could you say that this is wrong?
It's true, yeah.
And actually, you do even see a push within the LGBTQIA++ revolution. It's a long alphabet now, lots of stuff there. But there's even a push to be more open to pedophilia to one degree or another.
And for a while, there were groups, they're much smaller than how well-known they are today, but things like NAMBLA, you know, going back into the 90s, North American Man-Boy Love Association, their slogan was, "Eight is too late."
Wow.
And so that's been going on for a while, but it was kind of extremist, but now it is much more mainstream for a lot of people.
But within the biblical worldview.
I'm trying to not have steam come flying out my ears because this one's very disturbing.
But the point within the biblical worldview is we have a reason for saying this is wrong.
Yeah.
We have an absolute standard to say it deserves punishment. Something needs to happen here to separate this individual from the rest of society. In the biblical worldview, we have a hope for every sinner, even this person, that they will turn to Christ, turn away from their sins, that even these sins have been paid for on the cross, which is an amazing truth when you think about the depravity that's being displayed here. And so we have an understanding, why is there evil like this? Well, because man's sin brings death and corruption into God's creation. This is perversion brought about by the sin of man. So within the biblical paradigm, we've got an answer for all those things that can direct people to Christ, the ultimate answer. Without Christ, without God, without the biblical absolutes of Christianity, then you cannot definitively say this is wrong. You really can't. And it shows how vacant, really, secular worldviews are.
Yeah,
but it shows how... Well, go ahead. I was going to say it shows how we instinctively know. Even people who are not Christians, many of them, will automatically say, yeah, this is...
We're made in God's image.
This is dead wrong. Other than people who have their consciences completely seared. But most of them would say, yeah, this is wrong. You can't be doing this. Because God has given us a conscience. And, boy, to get to this point... Can we go on to the next one? It's not a whole lot better, but... Biden administration promotes Transgender Day of Visibility on Easter Sunday. Now, of course, Easter Sunday is what we have traditionally celebrated, in not just in the U.S., but in many nations around the world, the day that we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Of course, I have argued for a very long time, you don't celebrate the resurrection just one day a year. As Christians, we celebrate every day of the year, okay? So don't save it for one day a year. Now, this is something, this Transgender Day of Visibility, apparently has been going on for about 15 years, but it was never, like, officially... promoted or recognized now let's pick the day where it falls on Easter now, or let's the year that Easter falls on that day. Now let's celebrate that. And so, Patricia. Yeah.
Well, we are seeing more attacks, even though this isn't something that falls on Easter every year. We are seeing more attacks specifically on Easter as a Christian holiday where we celebrate the resurrection. I'm from Canada, and I know the Canadian government's Veterans Affairs got some slack for wishing people a happy March holiday right before Easter, even though March holiday actually will be on April next year, but we don't have to talk about that. But then actually, from this article, they switched gears and started talking more about the resurrection. So it's an example of how you can take current events and use them as openings for sharing the gospel. And he had some interesting things to say after that as well.
Yeah, and as you look at this too, it's very interesting. We often say this. We all have a religious ideology. There's no neutrality. You put your faith in one place or the other. And the ideology that is attempting is really kind of co-opt the thinking of our nation, rooted in this kind of wokeism, the LGBTQ movement. It is a religious ideology. It has special holidays and holy days it wants you to celebrate. So it wants you to celebrate its holy days. It has things it wants you to worship. It has certain creeds it wants you to say. And if you won't say them, well, you'll get in trouble, kind of like blasphemy laws. We saw one of those in Scotland fairly recently. Hopefully it gets overturned. But where if you are accused of... committing a hate crime by saying something that would stir up some sort of hatred against someone in the trans community, you could be convicted up to, I think, 7 years in prison.
In Canada, they're having hate speech laws up to life. Life in prison. You can get more time for hurting someone's feelings than for murdering someone.
But what is that? But it's a modern-day blasphemy law. If you say anything against our stated religious ideology, our felt ideology, you speak against it, we will punish you accordingly. And so there's no neutrality. You got to keep that in mind. We buy that lie all the time. Neutrality doesn't exist. This is a different religious ideology built in man's ideas as the authority, and it leads to many bad consequences in our culture.
Yeah, so Brian mentioned they have their own holy days, their own holidays. So with all of June, right, Pride Month, you've got the, let's see, Stonewall Riots anniversary, June 28th. You got Non-Binary Awareness Week, July 8th through the 14th. You got International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia, May 17th. You got Odd Gender Pride Day, May 19th. You got Harvey Milk Day, May 20th. Oh, we're just in a couple of months.
When there's like 100 genders, you can cover a lot of the year with that.
Right.
Get a holiday for every day.
Practically,
right,
yeah.
Pretty much, right?
So it's not as if they need another day when there's already a whole month established, but it's just... like Brian says, in a sense, it has become a religious ideology to a lot of these people. And it just is another symptom of what we see in our culture as we drift further and further from God's word and God as our ultimate authority. And anything goes. And we're seeing that. Not that we're advocating that anybody go out and be hateful or have any violence toward anybody who who identify as one of these? Of course not. We're commanded to love one another, to love our neighbor as ourselves, to love our enemy. They fit one of those categories, or two, depending on where they're at.
Right, and share the hope in Christ that we have from the resurrection.
Right.
The article took a really interesting turn, too, though. This article was kind of, it took like a right-hand turn to a different topic almost, or related to it. So, of course, this is all about having this day of visibility on Easter, and then the author of this article goes into a defense of the resurrection straight from that.
Can I do that for a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think you got a book on that, right?
I do, actually. So this is a book I wrote several years ago called In Defense of Easter, Answering Critical Challenges to the Resurrection of Jesus. It goes through a lot of the many evidences we have for the resurrection. There's a reason why it's been called one of the most well-proven events in ancient history. And then it goes through all of these alternative scenarios or views that the skeptics have tried to come up with for the last 2,000 years to try to explain away the evidence for the resurrection. And then there's 9 chapters about the implications, practical implications of the resurrection.
Sound like you've talked about this before.
I have a few times, yes. Actually, it's my favorite topic. So
we're
not going to talk about anything else right now. We're going to just talk about the resurrection.
Well, we did interview you about the resurrection for our podcast, Zero Compromise.
That's
so
right.
You can go listen to that. It's a really great episode.
That's right.
If Tim gets rolling, we'll be here till 4. Just sit back.
Patricia's
relax,
like, this is how I get him to stop talking. Go watch my show.
Well done. Thank you. I thought that was a great segue.
So there's plenty of evidence for the resurrection. Of course, the best evidence we have for that is that God's word tells us multiple times Jesus rose from the dead. And if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you know full well he rose from the dead because he's changed your life. He's alive in you and making those changes. So, all right. I got to still talk about it. No, we'll move on. I just see the next picture. I was like, can I please still talk about the resurrection instead of Richard Dawkins? But that's who we get to go talk about next is the atheist, Richard Dawkins. His latest culturally Christian comments show that he still doesn't get it. So several years ago, I think it was back in 2007, Richard Dawkins made waves throughout his life. Of course, he's a very outspoken atheist, probably the most well-known atheist in the world. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's written a lot of books against God, and called The God Delusion was the big one. And so in like 2007, he made waves by saying, well, maybe it wasn't such a great thing that Christianity is fading from public view in the UK, which is where he lives, because what's filling its place is Islam, and he's like, oh, that's not good culturally.
Not quite as friendly to people who don't agree with him.
Right, and so now he is doubling down on that in several ways.
Right, so he's calling himself a cultural Christian now, which there really isn't such a thing. You're either in Christ or you're not. But he's saying that he likes the foundation for morality and human value and justice and rights that Christianity actually gives you, which his worldview doesn't. So he has to borrow it.
He likes the cultural trappings, essentially. He likes that there are laws about certain things. He likes singing carols. He likes some of the tradition.
And he realizes, too, that the worldview and the biblical parameters of values and morality that the Bible provides within that biblical worldview, it creates a society that is good to live in, that is more safe, it is usually more productive, it flourishes more, at least the human flourishing, because God knows what he's doing. He's told us how to order society. If you follow his plan, things tend to work better. Now, not every time in a fallen world, but they tend to work better if you follow his laid out program and his word. And Richard Dawkins has recognized that. It's funny though, what he wants is Christianity without Christ, and he wants that Christian culture without people who really believe in Christianity really to the core of their heart. And so basically the problem for him is this though, you don't get a Christian culture without authentic Christians who are actually living Christian lives that produce the structure for that particular Christian culture. Without them, you don't have the structure at all.
Right.
And so he's kind of in a conundrum from him, and he's rebuking his own self.
Right.
Look at his older writings and his older books and older interviews. He would staunchly say that atheism, rationalism, that is the way to go. Every religion is evil and broken, and the best possible outcome for people would be get rid of all of it and just have an atheistic, rational, scientific worldview. Now he's saying, I don't like the fruit of that worldview. I want the fruit of the Christian worldview just without Christ.
Right. And if you look at some of his older writings, the things he would say about God, like the God of the Old Testament is, and then he'd go on and give, you know, like 30 different adjectives like that are too long for us to even pronounce, but he tried to make God seem as horrible and vile as possible.
Yeah.
And now he's saying, well, I'm a cultural Christian. Why would you come in any way, shape, or form identify that if that's what you really think God is like?
Right. So he's like basically asking people to act as though Christianity is true, but like just pretend it's true. But you can't just tell people to do that.
Right.
It's like when you're 5, hey, can we pretend to play zoo or something? Like,
right.
Just pretend it's real.
You can't build a society on it. Philosophers call it a useful fiction, but people don't actually live that way. And it's interesting. The article gets a little bit philosophical, but it talks about the French Revolution, when people basically did just kind of say, well, let's just assume that these rights exist, but kind of without any personal God, the supreme being. And it started out like it sounded good, but then they were able to just rationalize murdering thousands of people in the name of the greater good.
The reign of terror.
Exactly, because they didn't have that foundation to explain why every human life should matter.
Yeah, if you look at the difference, and I know there's a lot of differences between like the French Revolution and the American Revolution. The American Revolution sets up a society built on Judeo-Christian values and worldview, whereas the French Revolution is more of an atheistic one, and it was a disaster, and it has still had repercussions to this day.
Yeah, yeah, and it shows you, like, when you get rid of God as the authority for truth, you either have human reasoning or human feelings as the authority. So human reasoning, you have, so like modernism, that we can solve everything through science, and if all the people just agree on what's reasonable, we can make society work that way. Problem is, reasonable people don't agree about what's reasonable because they're reasoning from different starting points and starting assumptions. Other side is feelings, but people's feelings also contradict.
Which is kind of where we're at today in our culture, is really feelings driven.
Yeah, we've kind of moved away from the reason, and in either case, you end up with a situation where you can't make people get along, so someone else has to act as though they're God, and that's where you get things like totalitarianism. So, all the consequences Dawkins wants to avoid.
Right, so he said, if I had to choose between Christianity and Islam, I'd choose Christianity every single time. And he was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan lights were hung on Oxford Street rather than Easter lights. So the UK is doing as well, replacing Easter with something else. So that was Richard Dawkins. All right, on to one that is, I think, a lot cooler.
Tim's wheelhouse. Here we go.
All right, here we go. So archaeologists discover Canaanite Temple of the Rising Sun near Jerusalem. So about 30 kilometers southwest of Jerusalem is the Elah Valley. And
but you've been there before?
So, Brian, I told you I had a surprise. This is a picture I took while I was there and standing on Soko. That's the hill that the Philistines would have been on, so where the picture is taken from. And then across the way is where the Israelites would have been. And in the middle is where David and Goliath battled. It wasn't a very long battle. It was over pretty quickly.
Now, did anybody throw any stones at you while you were there?
I get pretty nervous when I'm there, so I don't like people named David. So they make me nervous.
Tim's really tall.
Yes.
In case you can't tell when he's sitting down.
But the red arrow at the end pointing to the end of that is Azekah. That's where this temple was located. So this dig is going on, and actually if we zoomed in on that picture, you'd be able to see some of the excavation work there. I just had to brag to Brian that I'd been there because, you know, that's our thing.
I used to pick on him about not going to Australia. I'd been there for 3 months in the past, and he'd never been before, and he wanted to go. But now he's been to Australia. I've never been to Israel. Now he rubs that in. Thanks, brother.
That's right.
Appreciate your ministry.
All right. So anyways, a very cool find. It's something that took place during the period of the Judges, and they were able to they're still excavating, but the things that they found here, some of the things that are unique, that they find a lot of pottery that's broken in the base of the temple, which that's traditional to have some, but this is just an inordinate amount, and they're not quite sure why that's the case. They had some speculation, but a lot of Egyptian influences on this as well, which is rather interesting. So this is taking place a couple hundred years or so before David, when this would have been in use, if you want to put a time frame on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought it was really cool that it's like a biblical location talking about biblical people, and they're finding artifacts that the Bible talks about, like the Baal idols. So it's just a neat example of how when you appreciate that the Bible is the real guide for reality and you treat it as if it's true, you actually find how reality supports what we find in the Bible.
I think the name for this particular place it has a different name that you find in the Bible for that same location.
Well, the Bible even mentions Azekah, so it does mention the Elah Valley, the picture I showed.
Right.
You want to see it again, Brian?
Yeah, I didn't see it again. It's so, first
time. It does mention that they were between Soko, and which is where I was standing at the time, and Azekah.
Right.
And so it's kind of at the end of that valley. But, the Bible didn't specifically single out this temple or anything like that, but it's actually real close to the town of Gath, which is where another famous person was, where Goliath is from. And we found it archaeologically, we found things there as well. We found from the 10th century BC, right around the time of Goliath, we find two different potsherds that have the name, very similar names to Goliath, meaning that name was in use at that time in that city. It wasn't something written 500 years later where somebody's just making up the story about a giant and a shepherd boy.
Yeah.
It's somebody who was there at the time writing about it.
which is an awesome confirmation. And then they make note, too, that it seems like the civilization collapsed and the multiple other civilizations kind of rose and fall, and they're trying to figure out, it's a mystery to them what caused the collapse. Although I did love this. So it said, these civilizations collapsed. They rapidly disappeared for reasons still unclear, though climate changes are believed to have played a key role.
Always climate change.
Or aliens.
We don't know what happened, but climate change had to do it right. In some way, shape, or form. I'm like, really?
Yeah, and it's possible that this is something that was going on during the period of the judges. There's this ebb and flow of the judges freeing the Israelites from the oppression that they're getting from, whether it's the Philistines or the Midianites or whoever it might be during the period of judges. So this is in Samson's area. But the Bible doesn't say anything about this temple at the time, so I'm not going to claim that, well, Samson went and knocked this one down too, but it's in that region where he was operating.
And we got some good books online you can check out that really show how archaeology confirms the Bible in very powerful ways. So go to our website, answersfromgenesis.org, for a couple of those.
And since you guys in the audience are here today at the museum, you can go to the Biblical Authority exhibit and see some examples of that as well.
Oh, yeah. You took a couple of pictures in there, right?
And actually, two of the photos in there, the Tel Dan Stela and the heel bone with a spike driven through it, the Yehohanan. So that was cool. So yeah, I think that was during one of my trips to Israel.
One of your many trips to Israel. Yes. We know, Tim. All right. Thanks.
I just want to make sure you remembered. All right. And last and, well, not least, well, smallest maybe. So Earth is spinning faster than it used to. And clocks might have to skip a second to keep up. So maybe you've heard of it before, but we've had in the past, every few years, we have something called a leap second. And that is because the Earth seems to have been slowing down. And so in order to align the clocks, like the astronomical clock with the atomic clock, basically, we'd have to like skip 1 second every few years. Well, now it seems like there's an adjustment that has to go back the other way.
Is that from climate change too?
Well, actually, that's one of the speculations. It is one of the speculations. Actually, one that I think kind of made a little sense, at least in my head, where if you do have more of the ice melting from the polar regions, at least from over land, you're going to get more water in the oceans, and that bulge that happens at the equator would be a little bit greater. And when, like, but they compare it to like a figure skater, when they put their arms out further, then they spin slower. So.
Maybe.
That made a little bit of sense. I don't know if that's exactly why, but that was one of the explanations.
And they also said it can have to do with like unpredictable things going on in the Earth's molten core as it spins as well. So actually, it had been spinning slower, right? And now it's starting to speed up. So we're seeing that.
Just shows we don't know as much as we thought we knew, which is kind of the general trend of so many of these articles, all right? Which shows the complexity of God's grand design. And we think about even what the rotation of the Earth actually does for us, giving us our days and our nights. And you think about the sun, moon, and stars giving us for signs and seasons. And like the eclipse that just happened not that long ago, which wasn't
climate change.
Which was not climate change. Someone actually said the eclipse was climate change. It was not. But
that
it was a beautiful
on the
display
view.
On the view, yeah. A beautiful display of God's glory. Did anybody see totality of the eclipse? Ooh, wasn't that awesome?
Man,
that was so cool. And by the way, on Friday, Dr. Danny Faulkner had a big old group over in Muncie, Indiana, where we went and watched the eclipse, record a lot of videos. There'll be some great videos dropping on Friday on his Facebook page, on the Answers in Genesis Facebook and YouTube pages. Be sure to check those out.
Some of us were, you know, dedicated to working and speaking that day, right, Patricia?
I was speaking at the Ark, which
here.
I really appreciated all the people who came and watched during the eclipse. My talk was a little eclipsed, but that's okay.
Wow.
Can't resist.
Rob will be so proud.
He will be.
But, and by the way, in case you're wondering, if it keeps going the way it is, we'll have to do a negative leap second in 2029.
Yeah, prepare.
So you'll lose 1 second in 2029.
So make
just
sure you
get
ready to post on your Facebook how much you got to grumble about losing 1 second of sleep at that time. Just like every year, people let daylight savings. Okay, get over it. It happens every year. It's 1 hour.
Right.
But
Big deal.
We got some really good books. Speaking of Dr. Danny Faulkner, our in-house astronomer, dealing with how really the heavens declare the glory of God. Some great books, The Creative Cosmos. Heavens Declare the Glory of God, great picture book, showing many beautiful things in there, and giving you a good biblical perspective on those things. So I encourage you to check that out.
And it's just another reminder of how amazing our Creator is, that He has put us in a spot where you can actually see a complete eclipse like that, because if the moon was any closer, you're not going to get anything like that. If it's further away, it's not. If it's different size, it's not. All of that has to be exactly right for that to happen.
The moon is 400 times smaller than the sun. The sun is 400 times further away. Therefore, it matches up perfectly to give you a total eclipse.
That's convenient.
All by chance,
right?
According to the evolutionist. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, it's a good thing that they can't manipulate genetics on that and get like two moons or something.
A moon with six legs. Yeah.
All right. Well, before we get too silly up here, let's talk real
quick
about
the
Great Jungle Journey. This is our upcoming VBS, and each year our VBS program is growing and growing and growing. We get thousands of churches that are using this every year. I've got to see an operation several times at some churches that I've been able to speak at, and it's a lot of fun. So if you're in charge of your VBS program and you're still looking, make sure you jump in on this one.
I also plug this one too, because our VBS, I mean, like all VBSs, it's got all the fun bells and whistles, the activities, the fun crafts. It's got all of that, so it's very engaging. But then it's also got really the good content our ministry is known for, the meat, the defense of the faith, the proclamation of the gospel, sound biblical teaching that really connects to people's lives at any age level. It's so well done. So you get all the fun stuff, but also with the good content our kids so desperately need, that with their faith being attacked in the culture we live in today.
All right, and this might seem like we're doing it a little too early this year, but not really. We are advertising our Answer for Women conference for next year already. It just happened just a week
just
and a half ago
right.
at the Answer Center, and no, it's just last week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are already 2,500 people for those two. They've sold 2,000 seats already for next
wow.
year.
It's very popular. It's always good.
Yeah, that's a good thing, but we hear all the time from the ladies that they really appreciate this, kind of like what Brian was talking about, because of the meat or the depth of the teaching that they get at this conference. So if that's something that interests you, go to answersforwomen.org and find out more details and get signed up already for next year. All right, well, that is all the time we've got for you today, and we appreciate you guys coming. Thanks for everybody online. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. God bless.
See you guys.